Welcome to Weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia, and I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS FM and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. We've decided to pick a completely non-controversial topic today, one that, I think it's just so dull, so boring, you'll probably fall asleep. Nobody cares about the Ten Commandments. Sorry, just kidding. Of course, this is among the most controversial of modern constitutional law cases. It's in the news every day. We have controversies ongoing in Northeast Tennessee. We have ongoing controversies in the Commonwealth of Virginia that I'm aware of. Controversies all across our great nation, and they all share very common facts. Basically, some government institution, it could be a school board or it could be a local city council, decides to put up a copy of the Ten Commandments. Or maybe they've made that decision decades and decades ago, but somebody at some point decides to post a copy of the Ten Commandments in a public space. And then someone comes along and says, "I object." That looks to me like an establishment of an official state religion. It looks to me, says such a plaintiff, that you, government, are telling me, citizen, that that is the official creed of our nation. Now, whether that's true or not, well, that's always a matter of fact, and that's always a matter of dispute. But if the plaintiff can convince a court that that's what's going on, then we have a violation of a part of the First Amendment that's called, appropriately enough, the Establishment Clause. Now, I had the great good fortune of meeting a fellow who knows all about this stuff recently. His name is Professor Peter Irons, and regular listeners will remember that I spoke to Peter recently about a different case, a case involving a criminal case, a death penalty case, the House versus Bell case, that was described in his current book, his most recent book, called The Steps to the Supreme Court. This is the other case. The Ten Commandments cases that I'm about to discuss with you are the other cases discussed in Professor Irons' wonderful, wonderful book that details how a case gets to the Supreme Court, what happens to it when it's there, and what happens after the fact. I met Professor Irons at Montpelier on a recent trip there to work on a Bill of Rights project, and let's go right now and let him tell us all about this fascinating area of constitutional law.
As a little background, the Constitution in the First Amendment, the first 16 words of the First Amendment, deal with religion. And they say, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof."
The first freedoms.
So those are two separate clauses, and they sometimes come into conflict. For example, what to one person might be their exercise of religion, to another person might be the government imposing some kind of religious orthodoxy or establishment. And the framers of the Constitution, James Madison in particular, was very concerned about religious establishment. Virginia had an established church at the time, the Episcopal Church, or then the Church of England.
Right, Anglican Church, right.
The New England colonies had established churches, most of them congregational churches. And about seven of the 13 colonies did have established churches.
That was a very familiar concept then.
Under those establishments, citizens were required to pay taxes to support the established church, even if they didn't belong to it or opposed to it.
Okay, so let's illustrate that. If I'm a Baptist in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I want to just go about my Baptist life and do my Baptist thing and go to my Baptist church, well, maybe I could and maybe I couldn't, but at the very least, I'm going to have to pay taxes that go to pay the Anglican priest down the street.
And if you didn't have a license from the state to preach, you could be put in jail.
Yeah, and a lot of Baptist preachers weren't they?
In fact, in Virginia, there's a Baptist minister named Witherspoon, who was actually put into county jail. Mm-hmm. For preaching without a license. And the funny thing about his case was that they built a wall to separate his cell window from outside so that people standing below the jail couldn't see him. But when his parishioners wanted to have a sermon from Reverend Witherspoon, they would come to the fence and they would raise a flag over the wall and wave it, and he would come to his cell window and preach to them. And he was finally released when, of all people, Patrick Henry, who was an opponent of ratifying the Constitution up to the very end, represented him and had him released from prison. So,
well, that's interesting. You should mention Patrick Henry, because he was a great proponent of the established church in Virginia. So that, well, good for Patrick Henry. So he didn't want to go quite so far as to jail dissenting preachers?
That's right. He felt that that was reaching too far to suppress religious dissent.
But nonetheless, he would have been very happy to have those parishioners in the Baptist church pay taxes to the Anglican church.
That's right.
So he only went so far in his tolerance of dissent. Okay.
But he did get Reverend Witherspoon released.
Well, okay. Well, good for Patrick Henry. All right. So that's what an established church means.
That's right. It's established by the state.
An official state church.
Right.
Okay.
And Madison in particular, and Thomas Jefferson as well, but mostly Madison. Madison wrote what was called a memorial and a remonstrance in 1774, in which he attacked the practice of established churches and taxation.
Right.
The
established church had existed before the Revolution. It sort of fell by the wayside during the Revolution, and then people like Patrick Henry, including Patrick Henry, were trying to reestablish the church in the Commonwealth of Virginia after the Revolution, and that was in response to those efforts that Madison did his memorial and remonstrance, and he defeated that.
That's right.
He defeated the reestablishment of the Anglican Church in Virginia after the Revolutionary War.
Well, when the time came for the Constitutional Convention in 1787, Madison, in fact, and this is not a well-known fact, opposed the addition of a Bill of Rights to the Constitution. On the ground that it was unnecessary and superfluous. Mm-hmm. In other words, his argument was that if a power is not given to Congress or the national government to do something like establish a church, there's no point in barring that practice. But the anti-federalists demanded that they would not ratify the Constitution without the addition of a Bill of Rights. So Madison agreed in his first term for Congress that he would introduce a Bill of Rights, although he once called it this nauseous project of amendments.
Wow.
But he went ahead because he'd made a political agreement to do so. Draft a Bill of Rights. He drafted one that finally was passed by both the House and the Senate that in its first version had simply said there shall be no established church in the United States or any of the states, meaning a particular denomination. But by the time it was finally revised in the form it is now, no establishment of religion, a term that is not otherwise defined, that satisfied most of the anti-federalists. Mm-hmm. And so it was in 1891 made part of the Constitution.
Excuse me, 1791. That's right.
At any rate, with the single very important exception of race, there has been no issue that has lasted so long and so divided both the American people and the Supreme Court as religion. Mm-hmm. Race, of course, slavery was written into the Constitution. It took a civil war to abolish it. And then with the loss of 600,000 lives, and then the long period of Jim Crow that lasted until the 1950s. But religion, interestingly enough, did not become a significant issue before the Supreme Court until 1947.
Everson?
The reason for that is that The First Amendment says Congress shall make no law. Well, Congress did not make laws respecting religion during that period. This was all done by states and local municipalities. So a case came up in 1947. It's called Everson versus Ewing Township of New Jersey, in which a taxpayer had objected to the practice of the township reimbursing parents for the bus transportation of their students to high schools in the neighboring town or city of Trenton, because there were no high schools in Ewing Township. The only way kids could get to school was either have their parents or friends drive them or to take public buses. So they reimbursed parents whose children went to either public schools or parochial schools for the bus transportation. And it wasn't a lot of money. It was like $40 per family for a year, a total of about $1,000 for the township. But this man named Arch Everson challenged it, first in the New Jersey state courts, in which he lost, and then in the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court rendered a very odd decision in Everson. It split 5-4, upholding the bus subsidy. And Justice Hugo Black wrote the majority opinion. And he said, look, sending kids to school on buses, regardless of what kind of school they're going to, is a public safety issue. Otherwise, they'd have to cross, crowded streets and highways if they're walking to school. And it's like, subsidizing the firefighters and the police departments.
Right. Not everything that the state does for religion is really for religion. It's just because there are religious people in society who need buses and who need fire protection.
That's right. I mean, if your church gets on fire, the fire department will come and put it out, regardless of what denomination you are. Is that a help to religion, or is that simply a public safety issue for the entire community? Mm-hmm. That was Black's rationale. The four dissenters said, no, this is a direct subsidy for the parochial schools to pay money that they would otherwise have to cover themselves. But in the majority opinion, Black made a statement that all nine justices agreed with. And that was, he went through the whole history of religious persecution in the colonies in the early days of this, after the Constitution. And he said, he wrote a sentence that was very important. He said, in matters of religion, the state is a neutral and may neither advance nor inhibit religion. The state is a neutral. And he listed ways in which the state could not intervene on behalf of religion. So the principle of Everson, the neutrality principle, established in 1947, is still the guiding principle of First Amendment law. However, hundreds of cases have come up before the Supreme Court involving interpretation of the Establishment Clause and also the Free Exercise Clause, but particularly the Establishment Clause. Let's say, for example, that a state wants to subsidize textbooks and teacher salaries for parochial schools. This is an issue that came up before the Supreme Court and the court in the 1980s. And the court ruled that they couldn't do this because it would entangle the state in the affairs of religion, even if the courses, as the law provided, were secular courses like mathematics or geography, not religion courses. But the state would have to supervise. Is there any, would there be a math question saying, if you do 10 rosaries three times, how many rosaries do you do?
Right.
So that was called the Lemon test, Lemon versus Kurtzman,
right,
which had three what are called prongs. A law cannot either, if the purpose of the law cannot be to advance or inhibit religion. Mm-hmm. The effect of the law cannot be to advance or promote, inhibit religion. And the state shall have no entanglement right. with religion.
And it has to have a secular purpose.
There has to be that, what's called a secular purpose mm-hmm. behind the law.
That's the most severe, if you will, strict separationist test, we like to call it. People who believe there's a strict separation between church and state, that's their test. But that brings up another point, Peter, is that this is such a contested area of law, and there are so many cases. There is more than one test out there for the Establishment Clause. Lemon is one of them. Everson established this neutrality principle. That's come back in other later cases. And then there's a whole other line of accommodationist cases that that are just right. at least three different schools of thought in this area.
Well, the most recent test was devised by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. And interestingly, in a case in which she upheld the placement of a nativity scene during Christmas time in a public park in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. But at the same time, she said, well, that, you know, it's sort of benign because it's designed to bring people downtown, do shopping, and it is surrounded by other Christmas, what Justice Brennan once called Christmas clutter. Things like images of Santa Claus and reindeers and right. and snowmen. So that the nativity scene, which the court conceded was strictly religious, Christian, was only one of many and didn't dominate.
Right.
A lot of people, including the dissenters in this case, thought that was pure rationalization. However, Justice O'Connor adopted what she called the endorsement test. If a law or a practice constitutes an endorsement of religion, then it's unconstitutional. It's sort of a condensation of the Lemon test itself,
mm-hmm.
the endorsement test.
It really focuses on that neutrality rule.
You know, right.
If I can characterize it, you look at the whole circumstance. If it's a Christmas display, or if it's a Ten Commandments type display, or you know whatever the supposed endorsement of religion is, you look at the whole thing, and you say, on balance, an objective observer looking at that would or would not feel like the state's endorsing religion right. or religion over non-religion, or a particular sect over another one. But you can't leave that test without saying what its detractors call it. They call it the one reindeer rule.
That's right.
After the break in our constitutional quiz, we'll come back and speak some more with Professor Irons, who'll tell us some more about those troubling stone tablets that have been causing problems ever since Moses brought them down from the mountain. Stay tuned.
Now when Israel was in Egypt land,
let my people go.
Oppressed so hard they could not stand.
Let my people go.
So the Lord said, go down.
Go down.
Moses.
Moses.
Way down.
Down
in Egypt land. Tell old.
Well, once again, it's time for our constitutional quiz with Kelly Carmichael, the quiz lady from James Madison's Montpelier. Hello, Kelly.
Hello, Stuart.
What a pleasure it always is to see your smiling face.
Every week.
Every week. Well, who do we have on the line today?
We have Scott.
Well, Scott, where are you from?
I am from Ozark, Missouri.
From Ozark, Missouri. And are you ready to take the constitutional quiz?
I am.
All right, Kelly.
All right, Scott.
Give Scott a good one.
I do. I have a good one. I have one about naturalized citizens. Okay. All right, here's your question. Naturalized citizens, A, do not have the right to vote. B, are required to learn and speak English. C, cannot serve as president of the United States. Or D, are born on United States soil.
So only one of those four is correct?
Only one of those four is correct.
Okay. Scott, do you want to hear them again?
I'll pick D.
He's
ready to go.
He's ready to rock and roll.
Well, give him his Constitution and his t-shirt, right?
Well, I'm not ready. I want to hear them again.
Our law professor friend wants to have a conversation.
I'm moving slowly. You young people are way ahead of me. So why don't we go ahead and start beginning again. Let's go through them one by one. And Scott, you'll tell us what you think of them. What do we have again?
Sure. Naturalized citizens.
Naturalized United States citizens. Okay.
A, do not have the right to vote.
Do not have the right to vote. Is that true, Scott?
That is not true. Once they become a citizen, they have the right to vote.
Interesting. Okay, well, what about B? What's that?
B are required to learn and speak English.
How about that, Scott?
That is supposed to be one of the conditions before you're accepted to become a citizen.
Oh, so you need to know that before you become natural. That's a fine distinction, but okay. So I guess you're not going to choose that one either.
So all right.
What's C?
C cannot serve as president of the United States.
What about that one?
You have to be born in the United States to be president of the United States.
Oh, okay. So is that the one you want to pick then?
I was pretty confident it was D, but I could be wrong.
Well, wait a minute. No, I'm not trying to make a choice for you, but didn't you just tell me?
He always tries to trip him up.
No. I mean, a naturalized citizen is somebody who wasn't, you know.
Right,
a
not
citizen.
Born in the United States, that came into the United States,
right,
and went through, become a citizen.
Okay, so is that...
And so they cannot serve as president.
Okay, and that's what C says. So is that your choice, or...
What did C say again?
C cannot serve as president of the United States.
Okay, then we'll go with C.
Let's talk about D then, one more time.
D is are born on United States soil.
Naturalized citizens are born on U.S. soil. How about that one?
Well, that's... Okay, I got confused with the question here. We're looking for naturalized citizen. Which one's wrong?
We're looking for the right.
It depends on the statement itself.
We're looking for the statement that actually fits, that is accurate. Yep. And so statement C said naturalized citizens cannot be president, but then statement D said naturalized citizens are born on U.S. soil. Is that an accurate statement?
No, it's not an accurate statement.
Okay.
It would be C.
So your choice is C. He was so certain at the beginning.
Now he's
certain about his new one. Okay.
I think you helped him out.
I heard...
All right, nice job, Scott.
All right, Scott, well done. You got it correct. C is the correct answer, so well done, Scott.
Thank you, sir.
You get a T-shirt.
I needed one of those.
Wear it with pride. Thanks for playing.
I will.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Bye. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor Peter Irons about the Ten Commandments, public spaces, the Establishment Clause, and a strange little thing called the One Reindeer Rule.
Well, here's a perfect example of that rule, Stuart. In a pair of cases that came out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, there was a nativity scene in the rotunda of the city hall, and it was placed prominently right in the middle of the rotunda. You couldn't come in city hall without seeing it. It was a very elaborate nativity scene, and at the top of it was an angel holding a banner that said Gloria in Excelsis Deo.
Okay.
And that was all there was. Now, a block or two down the street was the city was the county building. And in front of that was a, I forget how high it was, about 20-foot tall menorah, mm-hmm, which had been donated by a Jewish organization. Mm-hmm. And next to the menorah was a 30 or 40-foot tall Christmas tree decorated with lights and so forth. Well, the court held that the nativity scene by itself, with no surrounding other, you know, reindeer or anything else, was unconstitutional because it promoted and endorsed a particular religious belief, the belief in Christ's birth. Mm-hmm. However, the menorah, which was not as explicit as a symbol of the Judaic religion, was counterbalanced by the Christmas tree. So that was okay. Now, if they had put reindeer and Santa Claus and snowmen around the nativity scene in the courthouse, would that have been okay? So It's all...
Before we leave that one, Peter, that is such a great case. I love these cases where the Supreme Court takes two seemingly similar circumstances and then distinguishes them. And that's, I really like to dwell on that one when I'm teaching this. In each of those circumstances, the nativity scene in the courthouse or the Christmas tree and the menorah in the park, the court looks at the whole display and says, on balance, is this an endorsement of a religion or not? So the nativity scene all by itself, you walk in, it's inescapable. The state is saying, you know, we're Christians here, and everybody else had better watch out, or at least it's going to be second class. In the other one, you'd look at it and you'd say, oh, well, you know, they're celebrating the Jewish holiday that typically falls in, you know, I think it's in December, early December, Hanukkah, and the Festival of Light, the candles and the lamps and everything. And then the Christmas tree, which is a somewhat secularized, in fact, originated as a pagan symbol of that time of year. So, okay, well, you know, that's a bit more balanced. I mean, that's how they're looking at these circumstances. And that really is the rule here, isn't it? I mean,
well,
everyone is fact-specific.
The word that the court most often uses in these cases is context.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the broader context of the display to see if it is predominantly secular or predominantly religious, and whether a so-called objective observer, someone knowledgeable of the history of this whole thing, would consider it an endorsement of religion or simply an acknowledgement of history, of tradition, and, you know, not feel excluded. One thing that Justice O'Connor said was that the vice of these predominantly religious displays is that they create two classes of citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are insiders and think that the state is approving their religious beliefs, and those who are outsiders, people who have no religion or are Jewish or Buddhist or Muslim or of any other faith, who would feel excluded. So, as you said, this is very fact-specific and very difficult for many courts and judges to decide which side of this line does it fall on. Now, the reason I picked the Ten Commandments cases from Kentucky and Texas, both of which came up to the Supreme Court together from separate courts in 2005, is that they involved exactly the same symbol, that is the Ten Commandments. Now, the funny thing is that there are several versions of the Ten Commandments in the Bible. In fact, there are two separate versions, and if you compare them and add them all up, there are 17 different commandments, but most Protestants, and there are differences between Protestant and Catholic mm-hmm. versions of the Ten Commandments, and even within some Protestant groups like Lutherans and other Protestants. But the Ten Commandments, I am the Lord thy God,
right.
Thou shalt have no other gods before me,
mm-hmm.
Thou shalt not bow down before any graven image. Those are strictly religious commands. And then from the fifth through the eighth commandments, I think, are four prohibitions. Thou shalt not commit murder, or sometimes thou shalt not kill,
mm-hmm.
Thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now, those are prohibitions which have been part of the common law and part of the traditional law, and even before there was written law, in virtually every culture in the world that anthropologists have discovered, these were prohibitions for which people could be punished. Committing murder, stealing, committing adultery, although those laws have been pretty much written off the books,
mm-hmm.
and bearing false witness, which is perjury. So by themselves, they're secular. But as part of a broader set of commandments that are basically religious, you should obey these prohibitions because God said you should.
Right.
Not because it is beneficial to society that we not murder and steal and commit adultery and perjury, but because God decreed. Now, to get to these cases, in 1999, in the very small rural county in Kentucky, McCreary County, down on the border with East Tennessee, the county judge executive, it's a elected position, has no judicial responsibilities. a sort of an archaic title, but it's the chief county executive, a man named Jimmy W. Green. Now, Jimmy W. Green was a very interesting man. I met him and interviewed him for one of my books, who decided one day, since he was in charge of the county courthouse in Whitley City, which is the county seat, very small town, about 1,000 people, that he was going to post a copy of the Ten Commandments on the wall of the courthouse lobby, which he did. And much to his total amazement, a few weeks later, he got served with a lawsuit. And the plaintiff in the lawsuit, one of the two named plaintiffs in the lawsuit, was his cousin, Lou Ann Walker.
No way. I guess that's the way it always happens in small towns. Everybody's related to everybody else.
That's right. And Lou Ann and Jimmy grew up together. They went to the same elementary school and high school. They went to the same church, the Walker Chapel Baptist Church. Jimmy had come from the Walker line of in McCreary County and Lou Ann. And the other named plaintiff, a man named Dave Howe, who was a recent resident of McCreary County. Now, what that means is he'd lived there for 26 years. But he said, look, that makes me recent. I'm not part of one of the 12 tribes of McCreary County. And so they, with the aid of the American Civil Liberties Union of Kentucky, filed a suit against Jimmy Green and McCreary County and the neighboring county, Pulaski County, in which the judge executive had also posted the Ten Commandments on the courthouse wall. And Jimmy was absolutely astounded that anybody would object to the Ten Commandments. And Lou Ann said, look, I'm not against the Ten Commandments. I just believe in the separation of church and state. And that's the way I was raised. And so anyway, the case went up to a federal judge in Kentucky.
Before we go on, the theory here is that such a display, Ten Commandments, being explicitly religious, especially the first four commandments, violates the Establishment Clause, because even though it doesn't establish an official religion, it moves the state in the direction of establishing an official religion, specifically by the state saying, we endorse these principles. We therefore are saying that the state of Kentucky, specifically the McCreary County, endorses these principles. And again, to paraphrase Justice O'Connor, anyone who disagrees with this is a second-class citizen. So if you walk into the courthouse and you're a Muslim, or if you're a Jew, well, I guess not a Jew, but if you're a Muslim or an atheist or a Hindu, you know, you're going to have a serious question as to whether you're going to be treated fairly in whatever business you have in that county courthouse. So that's
or even Stuart, somebody like Lou Ann Walker, who in fact is a Baptist,
right?
But she feels that this is not the place to put the Ten Commandments, that they belong in people's houses or lawns or churches. Any private property.
She's that unusual plaintiff then who's truly doing this as a matter of principle, and in fact,
exactly,
is making herself rather uncomfortable, because I imagine people down at the Baptist Church are not very happy with her about this.
Well, Lou Ann said, interestingly, when I talked to her about this, that she did fear initially that there would be some bad reaction. In fact, she thought that somebody might try to poison her dogs, so she kept them indoors for a while. But she said, surprisingly, a number of people in the community would come up to her and quietly whisper, you know, Lou Ann, I'm on your side.
Very quietly.
But, you know, I can't say anything right about this.
And something else you said there I really want to emphasize. When someone like Lou Ann comes forward and says, I object to this, it violates the separation of church and state, it violates the Establishment Clause, that person is not saying that there's any restriction on what people can privately do. People can, of course, have the Ten Commandments at their church. They can, of course, have the Ten Commandments and, you know, a 10-foot-high sign in their front yard if they want it. They can put a bumper sticker on their car. They're saying that you can't take state money, you can't take public money, and use that money that we all have to contribute to, that we all pay taxes to support, and then use the state to endorse a particular religion. That's the issue.
That's right. And the counter argument to that, that Jimmy Green made and that many, many other people make, is why should one person be able to prevent the majority, the vast majority, from expressing their religious views? You know, it's what's called the heckler's veto. You know, if one person objects, well, the point is that, as Justice O'Connor said in her opinion in this case, when it comes to the First Amendment, we do not count heads.
And again, I hate to keep interrupting you, Peter. You're doing a great job in explaining this, but that's the whole concept of individual rights. I mean, we have a basically majoritarian system of government. That is, most issues, we get together, we count heads, we say, okay, the majority wants this, let's do it. Certain things, we've said, even if the majority wants to do it, you can't do it.
That's right.
And so that's the whole idea of an individual right, as you know, freedom of religion and the Bill of Rights, you know, whatever other right you want to identify, you don't count heads. That's the whole point. It's not the majority that rules.
That's right. And that was one of the points that Madison was most insistent on,
mm-hmm.
In when he finally drafted the Bill of Rights, rather grudgingly. But when he did, he made the point that the greatest danger to rights is the tyranny of the majority.
Yes, indeed.
So, and there are other cases, of course, dozens of other cases that I've been involved in and know about, in which individual plaintiffs who challenged things like putting the Ten Commandments in schools were, in fact, viciously attacked by local residents and townspeople. They lost friends. They even split up families. They had death threats against them.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. I'm speaking with Professor Peter Irons about the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment and its relationship to the posting of Ten Commandments in public spaces. These are very controversial cases, and they often result in lots of high emotion. And Professor Irons knows all about that. But let's take a moment and do our Madison Minute, and then we'll have a break and come back and talk about what's happening this week at Montpelier. Then we'll come back to the very serious topic of the Ten Commandments. Stay tuned.
In the early 19th century, many fashionable men and women dipped snuff, including Napoleon Bonaparte, Henry Clay, Queen Charlotte of England, and Dolly Madison. The nicotine stimulant, made from ground tobacco leaves, was typically stored in a small, highly decorated box made of silver, tortoiseshell, or other decorative material. Margaret Bayard Smith once said of Dolly that her snuff box had a magic influence and seemed as perfect a security from hostility as a participation of bread and salt is among many savage tribes, for who could partake of its contents offered in a manner so gracious and retain a feeling inimical to its owner? Marion DuPont Scott, Montpelier's last private owner, bequeathed Dolly's silver snuff box to the National Trust for Historic Preservation upon her death in 1983. The snuff box is currently on display in the Grills Gallery at Montpelier. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this time we're going to find out what's happening this week at Montpelier from somebody new.
I am Sean O'Brien, Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer of the Montpelier Foundation.
Wow, so you run the whole thing.
Currently, that is true. We are in a search for a new president for Montpelier. So hopefully very soon we will make another announcement about the new president, but in the interim, the chief operating officer runs the show.
I see.
Not your show.
Right.
This show.
This show. Well, I'm looking forward to you not having to do two jobs in the not too distant future.
I look forward to that as well, although I'm enjoying it immensely.
Okay. Well, Sean O'Brien, tell us, please, about Constitution Day. I think you want to talk about that.
I would love to. Constitution Day, as listeners to this show will know, is the day on which the Constitution was signed, which is September 17th of 1787. We are trying to make Constitution Day into a major national celebration, not unlike the 4th of July.
Right.
Only better. Because the 4th of July is the day that we thumped our chests and said, we're a country, here we are. Well, Constitution Day is the day when we told people, what kind of a country are we going to be? And that's the day when we gave people the text of our Constitution and said, this is the kind of nation we're going to be. We're going to be a representative democracy. We're going to have elected officers. We're going to have rights. And it's really an extremely important day in the history of our republic.
Thanks very much to Sean O'Brien. You know, I agree with him. Constitution Day should be celebrated just as fervently, just as joyfully as the 4th of July. So we certainly wish them well at Montpelier in making that a much more important national holiday. Now let's go back and talk some more to Professor Peter Irons, who's going to finish our discussion about the Ten Commandments and the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment.
The Ten Commandments case from McCreary County went to a federal judge in Lexington, Judge Jennifer Kaufman, who'd been appointed to the bench by Bill Clinton. She was known as a fairly liberal feminist judge, and she ruled that the display of the Ten Commandments violated the Establishment Clause and had to come down. Now, what happened was that a private religious right legal organization called Liberty Council contacted the county, contacted Jimmy Green, and volunteered to defend them in this case on appeal, and suggested that in place of the single placard of the Ten Commandments, that they place on either side of it other historical documents, the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the Magna Carta, the Mayflower Compact, and so forth. And that in this way, much like the reindeer and Santa Claus example of context, the Ten Commandments would not be the centerpiece of this display, although in fact it was still in the center.
Okay, so the Liberty Council suggested they create a broader context and that might pass constitutional muster. Okay.
And Judge Kaufman heard that motion and decided once again that the predominant purpose was to endorse religion.
Okay, now that's extremely important. So they started out with just the Ten Commandments. That was rejected, that was declared unconstitutional in the federal court. So they come back with this broader context. That's extremely important because now the judge is looking at the whole context of the case, not just what's there, but how it came to be there.
Exactly.
Okay, go on, please.
And she said that the addition of these other documents did not remove the taint, the constitutional taint, of the original display.
Okay.
Now, here's where it gets even more complicated and interesting, Stuart. The year after this case was filed in Kentucky, a case was filed in Austin, Texas, by a man named Thomas Van Orden, very unusual man. He was a lawyer by training, but he had lost his law license. He'd suffered some very serious personal, family, and emotional issues, fallen into a deep depression. The bar had lifted his license for failing to comply with various rules, including psychiatric treatment. And he became homeless. He literally was homeless. He was living in a tent under a freeway. But to occupy himself, he would go almost every day to the State Supreme Court Library in Austin, which was just about a couple hundred yards from the state capitol. And there's a big state ground there, like 17 acres.
So you have a homeless, disbarred lawyer who's the plaintiff. That is one of the most unusual plaintiffs I have ever heard of.
Well, he is. He's a very unusual man. And I have not met him. He keeps his privacy to himself, which is fine. But he filed a lawsuit pro se on his own behalf.
Mm-hmm.
and filed it in federal court. And the federal judge threw it out on the ground that the Ten Commandments display, which was outside the state capitol, it's 6 feet tall and 3 feet wide, has the exact version of the Ten Commandments that the one in Kentucky had. Hmm. But on the state capitol grounds are 17 other monuments to organizations like the Texas Rangers and Texas Frontier Women and Veterans of Wars. There's even a replica of the Statue of Liberty, which has very little to do with Texas history.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge reasoned that the overall context was secular.
So the judge looked at the entire courthouse grounds.
Right.
That was, and again, that's extremely important. Every case is fact specific, and it really is how wide a net the judge is going to cast here. So the judge said, okay, the context here is the grounds. And when I look at the grounds, I see not just the Ten Commandments, I see all this other stuff.
Right.
And that was okay.
That was okay to him. So Thomas Van Orden appealed that to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. And he went there and he argued the case himself. And he drew a panel that was very, very conservative. He said, it's like arguing before the Southern Baptist Convention. And they unanimously ruled against him, virtually repeating the district judge's opinion. And so he filed a petition for certiorari with the Supreme Court. At just about the same time that McCreary County filed its petition with the Supreme Court after the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld Judge Kaufman's orders.
Mm-hmm.
So you have two conflicting Court of Appeals decisions on virtually the same issue.
That's called a circuit split.
Right. And a circuit split is the kind of case the Supreme Court is more likely to take up so that it can resolve the differences and provide a uniform standard for all the lower courts, state and federal.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the cases came up together. Thomas Van Orden originally intended to represent himself and argue before the Supreme Court. But he also felt that there would be a huge media storm about the homeless lawyer in the Supreme Court. So he accepted an offer from a guy named Erwin Chemerinsky, who was a law professor then at Duke University, one of my law school classmates, a fantastic.
Oh, I didn't know that. He is a very nice man.
Yeah. He's now the dean of the law school at UC Irvine.
Yeah.
At any rate, Erwin argued the case, and the court was very, very, I wouldn't say hostile, but unappreciative of his argument that this Ten Commandments monument, placed in a setting of other monuments that were secular in nature, was actually endorsing religion.
Let me ask one question before you go on. How old was that Ten Commandments display? Do you have
that display? That's a good point, Stuart. That display had been put up in 1962, I think,
mm-hmm.
by a group called the Fraternal Order of Eagles. And they were then on a campaign, allegedly, mm-hmm. to prevent juvenile delinquency by putting up Ten Commandments displays so that supposedly young people would look at them and say, oh my goodness, I better not commit murder, adultery, theft, or
perjury. I'll turn over a new leaf because I've seen the display.
Right. And
okay.
And I'm going to do that because God wants me to behave properly.
Understood. Well, regardless
of at the same time, the Eagles had reached an agreement with Louis B. DeMille, the movie magnate, who was promoting a movie called The Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. And they donated these monuments. And it was a big publicity thing for the movie, which became a huge hit. I think it won the Academy Award.
Let my people go.
And
that was a great movie, by the way, Charlton Heston and all that. But that's interesting history. And my point is that the court will not just look at the context today. They will actually look at how long something's been around, because what they're ultimately trying to divine is the intent.
That's right.
They're trying to say, what is the intent of the state here? And if the state really doesn't intend to endorse religion, then they're going to be much more likely to uphold the display.
Well, the interesting thing about these two cases, Stuart, is that they were argued together at the Supreme Court same day. And a couple months later, the court handed down two decisions, 5-4 decisions. One decision struck down the display in the McCreary County Courthouse on the ground that it was an endorsement of religion, regardless of the expanded number of documents and the argument that this was, you know, not the central focus, because the initial purpose had been to display the commandments by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they handed down a decision 5-4 upholding the monument on the Texas Capitol grounds. And what happened was that one justice, Stephen Breyer, had switched sides in the two cases.
Wow.
He was in the majority in McCreary County, and he joined the court in a concurring opinion in the Van Orden case. He didn't join the majority, the plurality. A plurality is a decision by less than a majority of the court,
mm-hmm.
Which Chief Justice Rehnquist had written. But he joined a concurring opinion that said, based upon the whole context of the Texas display, the fact that it was old, the fact that nobody had challenged it for 40 years, the fact that there were all these other monuments around it, it doesn't have the same endorsement of religion as the Kentucky display. Well, what this produced, and there were a number of Ten Commandments cases pending lower courts at that time, what this produced was total confusion among lower court judges. I mean, the basic question they had to ask was, is this a McCreary County case or is this a Van Orden case? What kinds of factors do we take into account? You know, literally, like taking a sheet of paper and listing all the factors on one side and all the factors on the other side, comparing them and seeing which one predominated. And lower court judges in several cases, Plattsmouth, Nebraska, Everett, Washington, upheld displays that had been originally put up by the Eagles organization on the ground that they were more like Van Orden. They'd been there a long time. Nobody had challenged them until recently. But in another case from Haskell County, Oklahoma, a case that I got involved in, Court of Appeals, the district judge upheld the Ten Commandments on the county courthouse lawn. There were two other monuments on the lawn. One was to the Choctaw Indians, who made up a fair number of county residents, and the other was for war veterans. But the Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit said, no, this is a McCreary County case. It was put up recently. It was challenged almost immediately by a local resident whose name, ironically, was James Green, just like Jimmy Green in McCreary County.
Hmm.
And it was explicitly done. The person who donated the monument told the county commission that he'd been called upon by God to put the commandments up. And when the display was inaugurated and dedicated, all the county commissioners showed up and said, this is a Christian county, and this is what we believe, and all our laws come from these commandments. Well, the Court of Appeals said, look, it's indisputable that the purpose and the effect of the display is predominantly religious and sectarian, just one sect. So that was appealed to the Supreme Court. And the court refused to hear the appeal. It upheld the decision of the Tenth Circuit. So the Haskell County Monument had to come down. They, in fact, moved it 100 feet to ground that was owned by the American Legion. There had nothing to separate the two. There had no fence or anything like that. But at any rate, they had to remove it. But, Stuart, at the same time, two different panels of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals upheld identical Ten Commandments displays in courthouses in Kentucky. Exactly identical to the one in McCreary County, on the ground that the local officials had very astutely decided not to invite ministers to preside, had not made any religious comments, had said that this was educational in purpose. And one of the dissenting judges said, you just can't believe this. Right. You can't believe, the record makes clear this was put up for religious purposes. However, the American Civil Liberties Union decided prudentially, I guess, not to appeal those decisions on the ground that the Supreme Court might reverse McCreary. So what we have here is a good example, in my opinion, that these issues of religion, particularly in a society that is becoming increasingly diverse, that is, for the first time in recent years, a majority of Americans do not belong to a particular church. 70% of them consider themselves Christian, but many of those people don't attend church, don't belong to church. It's simply a sort of traditional kind of thing. Yes, I'm a Christian. But other groups, in fact, the two most rapidly growing religious groups in the country are non-believers, who now constitute about 14% or 1 out of 7 of the population. That is, people who will say, I am not a religious believer.
And that's probably an undercount
because a lot of people wouldn't want to admit it, even to a person taking a poll over the telephone. Mm-hmm. And the other most rapidly growing group are fundamentalist evangelicals. But even they, in recent years, for example, the largest denomination in the country, and many of your listeners undoubtedly know this and perhaps even belong, is the Southern Baptist Convention. Mm-hmm. The Southern Baptist Convention, in fact, is losing membership, along with the Catholic Church and most of the mainline Protestant churches, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, Lutherans, and Episcopalians. So the number of church-belonging, church-believing people in this country is shrinking. And people who have no religion or belong to, who are Buddhists or Muslims or Hindu, are growing. And so I think what we need to keep in mind is that in order to preserve that kind of civic civility and avoid these kind of conflicts that can sometimes break out in violence or threats, as I've experienced, is to simply separate the church and the state. People can establish churches, attend churches, contribute to churches, hold services whenever, wherever they please. They can even do so on public ground in certain circumstances. For example, if the Pope wants to hold a mass on the Washington Mall. Mm-hmm. I don't personally think that's a good idea, but I'm not going to object to it.
But religious groups are typically going to have the same rights to use the public park as any other
group.
Yeah,
they just can't permanently take it over.
Yeah.
But at the same time, there has to be tolerance for those of other faiths or non-believers. In Tennessee, for example, there's a controversy going on now about building a mosque in the town of Murfreesboro.
Right.
And a lot of people are very upset about that. They say, well, Islam is not a religion, it's a political terrorist organization. And this has created considerable amount of controversy. There's even been arson at the site of the mosque that's being built. And this illustrates, I think, why Madison and the other framers were right when they said, in Madison's words, there must be a complete separation of church and state.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks so much to Professor Peter Irons, who shared with us all of his knowledge and wisdom about the First Amendment, the Establishment Clause, and the Ten Commandments. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.